Diner, and we've got Congressman Jeff Duncan right here with us in studio. Captured him. He's going to be here for the hour, so we got a lot of good stuff to talk about. Congressman Jeff Duncan has been all over doing a lot of media today, and Congressman Jeff Duncan, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Ann. Now that I'm in the studio with you, the day is ending on a good note.
Well, that is good to hear. That is good to hear. So you opened up the GOP headquarters today?
We did at midday. We had ribbon cutting there. It's right beside Norman Utz's chiropractic, it's Calhoun.
Calhoun and Montague, right there.
And if you need supplies for any of the Republican candidates, the Republican headquarters is right there. It's got Jeff Duncan signs, of course, but Mitt Romney signs and bumper stickers and Mike Pitts and Shannon Riley and really all the county council races and everything. If you want to support a Republican candidate, it's right there at the corner of intersection, I guess, of Montague and Calhoun.
Absolutely. So, gosh, it's only a month away.
You know, it seems like it's taken forever to get here, but we're on the short road, and I know tonight with the debate, Mitt Romney and President Obama, it'd be interesting to see, you know, how those guys come out sparring. I think the first time on the stage together looking at each other in the eye. So I'm interested to see, how Mitt Romney performs after 21 debates in the Republican primary. It's been a while since President Obama's been on the stage having to answer questions from anybody, and especially another candidate. So it'll be interesting.
Will be interesting. I know a lot of Republicans are pinning a lot of high hopes on the debate tonight.
They are. You know, this is a debate where I believe they're going to be sitting at the table together, and I guess Jim Lerner will be they're moderating. They may be at podiums, but I think the format's probably more informal. But it is on the jobs and the economy. And I think that's a strong suit for Mitt Romney, and being the kind of business leader that he is. I think it's been a weakness of the Obama administration with unemployment at or above 8% for the whole 4 years of his term. And gas prices have doubled under his administration. We've spent $1 trillion or more dollars every year, more than we're bringing in. This is deficit spending 4 years in a row under his administration.
I guess that's why we have to raise taxes then, because you guys are spending more money.
So they
there.
Can continue the irresponsible spending. And
exactly.
You know, one thing I've been fighting for the 2 years I've been in Washington is basically responsibility. You know, doing what's right for the taxpayer, or doing what's right for a posterity in this country. And I don't want to saddle my children, and hopefully my children will have children, so my grandchildren, with more and more debt. And I believe we've got to rein in our spending and really start addressing how do we begin paying back the $16.2 trillion that we owe. I said trillion, folks. That's with a T. And
do you really
that's
need
a lot
to worry
money.
About it, though, Jeff? I mean, you know, I thought in times like this we just needed to spend our way out of this.
Yeah, I've never known any economy that could spend their way out. You know, if you borrow money and you've got you're facing foreclosure and facing bankruptcy, sure, just go spend more money and spend your way out of it and see how that works out for you. That's kind of where we are in a nation. And you know, one thing that amazes me is that I'm questioned about why would I even raise the questions about the deficit spending and the debt? And, you know, we've raised our debt ceiling 72 times in the past, so why am I, Jeff Duncan, a congressman, and some members of my freshman class, why are we even questioning the validity of raising our debt ceiling? Why are we asking those questions? Why are we bringing up concerns over our credit rating? It's never been brought up before. You know, well, one thing
our credit rating has never gone down before, has it?
That's right, and we're now 16.2 trillion, approaching 16.4 trillion in a hurry, and we better be alarmed about that. It's a national security issue, and that's the fiscal sanity of this country.
I understand that Boehner has called you, what was that, hardhead?
Hardhead, among other things, I'm sure. But,
that's the one that I heard, and I guess that wasn't a term of endearment.
I'm going to take it as a badge of courage, and you know, it was, I don't know if it was a term of endearment. I think it was taken, it was said in a slight toward me, but, you know, when it comes to my Constitution, when it comes to, you know, personal responsibility, individual freedom, individual liberty, when it comes to, you know, living within our means, when it comes to constitutional form of government, when it comes to limited government, free markets, I'm going to be unabashed about that, and I'm going to be hard-headed about it, because I believe we've got to return to the principles of our founding fathers. And so if you call me hard-head, stubborn, whatever, I'm going to be that way about those certain principles. I'm flexible when it comes to, you know, pathways to, as long as the means to an end are the right means. I understand politics. I understand working along together to get along and move along those lines, but not just one to go along to get along. That's not me.
Well, you know, I saw a couple of weeks ago when President Clinton was having his global initiative, and he was being interviewed, and he said that the deadlock that has been going on in Congress for the last year after the election, it would resolve itself because you would all have to work together. Instead of this, it's been the election that has kept everything from happening. What do you have to say about that?
You know, I'm glad he's not our president anymore, if that's what he thinks, because the gridlock that's there, you can blame the Republican-controlled House, but I'm kind of glad that the Republicans control the House, because I thought the last Congress was doing too much to erode our liberties. And so I feel like the little boy with his finger in the dike to keep all the water from leaking out. Maybe we're that little boy, but... I think President...
Do you think the lame duck session is going to be where the answers are made after the election?
No, that's the worst thing that could happen for this country. Why would we want to give, let's say President Obama gets defeated, he wants to have veto power until he leaves office in late January. So why would we give him something that he could veto? Why would we give him more veto power? Why would we give... say Barney Franks, who's not seeking re-election, why would we give him another vote in a lame duck session? Let's say some members get defeated, like Claire McCaskill in Missouri. Why would we give her another vote on something when the voters voted her out of office? And so I think the lame duck session ought to go away. I don't think we ought to do anything. If there's something that we have to do, such as a spending plan, or if there's something dealing with an issue of terrorism or something that has to be done, okay. But beyond some necessity for the country, I don't think we pass any major legislation in a lame duck session. I wouldn't support it because these people were defeated in November. The voters had spoken, and I don't think we ought to let them have another vote.
But comes January 1st, everybody's talking about this fiscal cliff.
It's there. It's a big cliff.
So therefore, somebody's going to have to make some decision before the first of the year.
Well, you know, not necessarily, because...
Oh, come on now, Jeff. Talk to me about that.
Okay. The fiscal cliff encompasses a lot of different things. The House, one of them is sequestration.
Yes.
The issue came about in the debt ceiling bill of late July and August of last year, when we created, the House created, and the Congress created a super committee to find cuts. They said we were going to find another $910 billion in cuts over 10 years, and these things just haven't come about because we all know the super committee fell apart, and sequestration was used as a tool to convince members of Congress to vote something they normally wouldn't vote for, saying, look, the super committee is going to be formed. They're going to find these cuts and help our solvency, and if they don't, then sequestration is going to happen. We're going to make these across-the-board cuts, specifically in the military, and nobody wants that to happen, so that's going to force the super committee to do its work. Well, we all know what happened. The super committee fell apart, didn't find the necessary cuts. Debt ceiling went up. We're running up a debt to $16.2 trillion today, and now we're facing across-the-board sequestration cuts that will affect the military. When I look in the Constitution, defense is one of the constitutional roles of government. So defense spending is part of that constitutional requirement. Now, we can have an argument about the levels of defense spending and other things another time, but I don't believe at this point in time we ought to have sequestration. I told them a year ago, and I feel like saying I told you so in a lot of ways, that we didn't think super committee would work. We didn't think we were going to be serious about finding the cuts, and here we are facing sequestration. So that's one of the fiscal cliff issues.
But what will happen if when will something be done to keep it from taking effect, Jeff?
Well, the House has already passed several pieces of legislation to deal with the sequestration, to find cuts in other areas, and the Senate has failed to act once again. The Senate has failed to act. It's been 12.
Will this be a lame duck session of the Senate that's going to make a decision?
Well, maybe they can take up a House bill that we've already passed. That is the big question. What I don't want is some spending bill that's a Christmas tree that they can hang a bunch of pet project ornaments on, earmarks as we call them, and get something passed with this thing hanging over our head. The way I see it, the House is act. The Senate needs to pass something. If it's different from the House version, we go back and we deal with a conference committee in a lame duck. We don't deal with passing major legislation in a lame duck session. We deal with the things that are already on the table. And the House version of sequestration cuts that are different from military is something that the Senate should take up. But I go back to the fact that the Senate hadn't passed a budget in our nation for 1,254 days or something like that.
It's a long time. Not that anybody's counting.
No, nobody's counting, surely not.
Now, but Jeff, what about, I mean, you're talking about sequestration, but what about the Bush tax cuts? Are those going to be, because they're talking about our taxes could go up anywhere from $400 for low-income people, median-income people, $2,500, $3,000 on up.
That's right. Something needs to be done about the Bush-era tax rates. I don't call them tax cuts. They've been established for 10 years now, so really they're tax rates. We either reestablish those tax rates and confirm that, or we allow rates to go up, or we look at tax reform and we look at all the taxes and also some of the loopholes, and we do a real tax reform package, which is what I'd rather see. In the meantime, we may have to pass some short-term extension of the Bush tax rates, and I'm all for that. That doesn't have to happen before January. That can happen early in January before the quarterly tax payments go out at the end of the quarter when you start paying your quarterlies. We can set the tax rates in January and make them retroactive to January 1, so that's no problem. But, you know, we'll see. If we've got a Republican president coming in office January 20th, we've got a Republican-controlled Senate, Republican House, I'd probably be a little more, warm fuzzy about the tax rates and feel like we would do the right thing for the American taxpayer.
Absolutely. Well, we are here with Congressman Jeff Duncan. You're up for re-election.
I am up for re-election.
2 years. Boy, it went by fast,
it
didn't
did. It? You were there. You were there for the swearing-in. You were there, and it has gone by in a hurry. I think we've moved the meter. We've definitely, you know, had an impact. I say we, the Wave Election 87-member freshman class that came in that were so excited about making changes to our country and returning to, you know, sanity in Washington. And I think we've moved the meter. I think we ran up against a number of obstacles, and we had that hard-head comment and other things. But I don't think we've lost focus, for the most part, on what we feel like we need to do for our nation, and that's returning to some basic principles. I've said all along, you know, Mitt Romney doesn't need to write a new business plan for the nation. Our founders already have written one. We just need to return to that.
Implement it again. Yes, absolutely. Hey, we're here with Congressman Jeff Duncan. If you've got a question or a comment, don't hesitate to give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We're going to hear a quick word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Here at Sharp Facets Gallery on the 72 bypass. Dennis Marks, a grad student. He wants to know, Jeff, he just called in, does Congress know actual costs before y'all vote on something? Can they not, can't they just not fund things that you don't want?
Yeah, I mean, the answer to this is kind of a two-part question.
Right, it is a two-part question.
CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, scores every piece of legislation that has a fiscal impact or has money attached to it spending on a program, and so we get a CBO score. But keep in mind, the CBO also scored Obamacare, and they missed it. And they missed it tremendously. So the cost of Obamacare to the American taxpayer and the government is a lot more than what they had scored it because, you know, I guess the Democrats gave them parameters for scoring that.
Well, it was 3,000 pages.
Yeah.
Nobody read it.
And a lot of ambiguity and a lot of free power to the DHHS to promulgate regulations for certain things, and those cost money to the taxpayer. But so that's the first part of that, is we do have an idea of what CBO score is. you know, the proof's in the pudding, so to speak. You know, once things are implemented, you realize what the true cost is, and Congress should go back and tweak that and make the changes that are necessary. That's what they do in the state when something's passed or a budget's passed, and we see projections come in short or whatever. They go back and change it and tweak those sort of things. So the second part of that was...
If you don't want to spend the money, why are we funding certain things that, since Congress actually has the power to not fund?
We do. Well, we don't have a budget. We talked about that earlier. So we're operating on a CR, a continuing resolution, spending plan for the nation. We had the opportunity in the CR to go in, and we did in the very first one, HR 1, back when I first started. We offered over 100 amendments under an open rule to limit spending to certain areas and do away with, zero out a lot of programs. Those were defeated by the Democrats and also some members of the Appropriations Committee, enough to get them 208.
Was that in the Congress?
That was in Congress,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was takes 218 votes to pass something or defeat something, and we saw amendment after amendment after amendment defeated by the appropriators, that they derive their power from appropriating money. And we're trying to zero out things like NPR and zero out the Legal Services Corporation and zero out money for Planned Parenthood and zero out a lot of other things, and they were defeated. And they were defeated with enough Democrats and a handful of Republicans to get them to that number. And so it's a challenge. When you don't have a budget, you have to do things like that. And here's the deal on, like, Libya or Egypt or some of those other things. We fund the State Department or the executive branch at certain levels. We have an authorization act for the Department of State. And so they're given X number of dollars to operate and also to fund, you know, USAID, which is a good program in some areas, but also as a way they funnel some money to certain places like Egypt and Libya and Kenya and other places we may not agree with. And so government needs to hear from people like this guy that you know, we shouldn't fund that. I agree with him. I put in an amendment on that authorization act that said any country that's the recipient of foreign aid from the U.S. in any shape, form, or fashion, if you receive foreign aid from us and you don't stand in the United States and vote with us at least half the time in the United Nations, not asking for you to vote with us all the time, I'm asking for at least half of the measures that come up, you ought to be able to find the will to vote with the United States on in the United Nations. Haiti votes with us. They were a huge recipient of our financial aid, especially because of the earthquake down there. They vote with us like 19% of the time. Don't hold me to that number, but it's, you know, what I'm saying is it's abysmal. The amount of the time that Haiti votes with the United States, its largest neighbor, its huge, we're their benefactor, and they can't stand with us in the UN and vote with us at least half the time. Come on, guys. So the amendment got passed after 3 hours of debate in that committee. It got adopted on that one bill that never made it to the floor, but it was an authorization act for the Department of State, and we didn't get it adopted. It was ended up being bipartisan, but you know, it was the right thing. So I'm working on those issues. It was, you know, it didn't go far enough, but it was all I could get. It was a step in the right direction to try to say we're going to limit who we give our foreign aid to, and we're only going to try to give it to people that are friendly to us. I mean, you can hate us for free. And there are countries around the world that hate us. They're recipients of our foreign aid. Well, they can hate us for free. Let's keep those tax dollars for ourselves, and let's help our country. That's just how I feel about it.
Who is it that was head of a lady that is in Congress, head of the budget for and has put a hold on the funds to go to Egypt, I believe it is? Foreign aid to go to Egypt.
Well, the head of the budget is Paul Ryan in the House, but probably Kay Granger on the Appropriations Committee.
Right,
She's an appropriator. She's probably a subcommittee chairman, but Hal Rogers is the chairman of Appropriations Committee, and Kay is one of the subcommittee chairmen. She's one of what we call the cardinals. You have the chairman, and then you've got all the subcommittee chairmen or the cardinals. That's a term. I have no idea what the history is there, but that's what they're called.
Right. So they did put a hold on the funds going to Egypt, didn't they?
You know, Ann, that's something I'm going to have to just defer to you on, because I don't know how they put a hold on them, maybe on future appropriations. But if Congress has already appropriated that money in a CR and that CR passed the House and passed the Senate, I don't know what mechanism we have to pull that money back or keep it from being funded unless Congress passes another piece of legislation where we all vote on it. And I think we all would vote to withhold that money, or definitely put some strings on it. So how Kay was able to do that, I don't know. But I think it's the right thing to do. You know, bottom line is Egypt as a whole isn't the enemy here. The Muslim Brotherhood isn't friendly to the United States. They're not friendly to Christians. They're not friendly to freedom-loving people that have republics like the United States. If you read the Muslim Brotherhood's creed and their motto, you'll realize real quick that, you know, they're all about, you know, recreating the caliphate. They're instituting Sharia law, or law under the Muslim religion. They believe jihad is their way and Allah is their goal. It's in their motto. So the Muslim Brotherhood's in control in Egypt. That's something to be aware of.
Absolutely. Now, but so you're telling me unless Congress actually votes to not fund something, and you have to have enough votes, but we don't have enough votes in Congress with a Republican Congress to do this?
We should.
Well,
what I'm saying is, I don't know how, we've already passed the CR.
Right.
Now, I will say this. The Senate, they worked until late Saturday, right before the end of September, because the fiscal year ended at the end of September. They worked on the CR, and whether they adopted the CR that we passed, the funding scheme, spending plan, or whatever that we passed, or whether they changed it, and we adopted their changes by unanimous consent, maybe she got somebody in the Senate to withhold that money and make a change to the CR. I'm not aware of that. I do know that she has said we're going to withhold those funds. How she would do that without us taking another CR up or passing another standalone piece of legislation that would withhold those funds, I don't believe she's got the power as an individual congressman, even though she's a subcommittee chair, to do that unilaterally. I think she would need all of us, and I haven't cast a vote on that. Now, I would cast a vote. I've cast those votes in Foreign Affairs Committee to limit those funds going to countries that can hate us for free.
Absolutely. Well, I would just was saying, in general, it would seem that with what the appropriations that you're talking about, that with a Republican, there would have been enough votes there to keep, to defund or not fund some of the things you were saying that you couldn't get through. That's kind of depressing.
You would think a Republican-controlled House would do conservative things and conservative spending, but that's not how it happened in H.R. 1, the very first CR back in the spring of 2011.
So we've had more since then, haven't we?
We've had some more CRs, and they have come to the floor in a closed rule. See, let me go back to the first CR. It came to the floor. Every bill that comes to the floor has a rule written for it. It goes to Rules Committee, and they determine how long we're going to debate that particular issue, how long the majority side, the minority side get, how many amendments can be offered, or whether it's going to come under a closed rule, which is no amendments can be offered, or whether it will come to the floor under an open rule, which is an unlimited number of amendments until we exhaust all the amendments that are offered. That's how it should work, as an open rule, and that's how it worked on H.R. 1. But since then, because of the hundreds of amendments that were offered and the time it took, leadership decided they weren't going to go with an open rule again. So they limited...
Boehner went with this?
The leadership as a whole, yes, ma'am. And so we see CRs and other things come to the floor either under a closed rule with no amendments being offered by members of Congress on the floor, and I'm not on the Appropriations Committee, so I can't offer amendments in Appropriations. I'm not on Rules, because I can't offer an amendment in Rules Committee. And if it's closed rule, I can't offer an amendment on the floor. Or it'll come in as a modified rule, where only amendments that come through the Rules Committee can be offered on the floor. Or it'll come as an open rule where it's just carte blanche and it's wide open and anybody can offer an amendment. We didn't see that on H.R. 1, I mean on any CR since then. And so I'm frustrated with that process because I'm an elected member of Congress. I represent you.
Right.
And if you and I come up with an idea to fund FCC or defund FCC, and I'm just using that as an example, then I ought to be able to offer an amendment on the floor that changes that spending.
Exactly.
So when a spending bill comes to the floor and I, as your representative, don't have the opportunity to put an amendment up to prioritize our spending in this country, then I've either got an up or down vote, yes or no, on that particular measure. And as you see, I voted no a lot because I'm frustrated with the process. The CRs that are coming to the floor, the spending plans coming to the floor in the House are things Harry Reid's already said that would pass the Senate. So that's what was crafted, something that would pass the United States Senate. Well, you know, I'm unabashed about the fact that I disagree with Harry Reid. We're diametrically opposed. And so if he's agreed that it would pass the Senate, I'm probably not going to vote for it on the House floor. And so I've relayed that frustration with leadership. I think we're moving the meter. I really do. But that's the problem of not being able to make those specific changes of funding governments that don't like us very much on the House floor.
Or any other agency that you want to pull the rug out under, like let's say GSA, with all their partying and everything going on.
Yeah.
You don't have the ability to defund it.
Not if that bill comes to the floor under a closed rule. I do not.
That's an interesting point we've learned here today, folks.
Yes.
That's something I wasn't aware of.
Absolutely. And so that's the frustration we as members of Congress feel when we're not on the Appropriations Committee. We can't get an amendment offered. We can't make the changes. And we're supposed to be a Republican-controlled House that lives within the principles of fiscal responsibility and restraint, ending the irresponsible spending, ending what's driving our deficits and our debt. And yet the only bill that comes to the floor that we have an opportunity to vote on are things that spend more money, borrow more money, and continue this irresponsibility. And so...
Here go the party of no.
Yeah.
Hence
the hardhead moniker.
Well, then it seems like there is no way to compromise. I mean, you know, to be able to say, well, we'll fund this, but we're not going to fund that. If you come in with a closed policy like that, there's no way to work, is there?
There's not. And then this current methodology that we're going through in Congress, you know, I've told Speaker Boehner and leadership this is, you know, let's bring bills to the floor that, you know, the Republicans can rally behind. Let's bring, you know, conservative legislation, spending bills to the floor that has a Republican stamp on it. And let's debate it. Let's have members an opportunity to offer amendments and make the changes if they can convince other members to support that and make the changes that are necessary. Let's send a conservative bill that we all, you know, you've got at least 218 Republican votes. They have trouble getting 218 Republicans out of 242 Republicans in our conference. So they have to go and get Democrats to vote with them to get something passed at 218 necessary votes. And so that's what happens, and that bill goes over the Senate. I've said all along, let's get something that gets the majority of the Republicans to vote for it. You don't have to worry about the other side. Let's vote for a Republican measure, and if it sets a level of spending that's a conservative level of spending, let's send it over the Senate. Then the Harry Reid Democrat-controlled Senate will jack that number up and spend more money than we can afford as a nation. America will see the differences between the Republican spending level and the Democrat spending level, and they'll see that difference, that juxtaposition of numbers, so to speak. And then it goes to conference committee, where that's the normal process. You've got a different version of the House, different version of the Senate. It goes to a conference committee. They work out those differences, and that's where compromise happens. And then you come out with a number somewhere in between, and the American taxpayer is better off than just starting at this high number that Democrats have said would pass the United States Senate. So hence my level of frustration.
I think hence all of our frustration. Hey, I'm Ann Eller right here with Congressman Jeff Duncan. If you got a question or a comment after what you've just heard, are you amazed? I certainly am. Call us, 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
This is Philip Biffle, your Greenwood Edward Jones Financial Advisor. Do you have a recovery plan for your investments? If not, there are several reasons we think you should. While interest rates are very low, certain income strategies and investments could help increase your investment income. Also, many investment portfolios are out of balance at a time when proper investment diversification may be most critical. You also may want to review your portfolio to consider replacing lower quality investments with higher quality investments that may be at attractive prices. No one can control what the market will do next. You can, however, take advantage of investment opportunities that exist today. At the same time, it is important to be well positioned for whatever the market does tomorrow. Please call me, Philip Biffle, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Please call me, Philip Biffle, at 229-0444, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing, member SIPC.
Monday, happy days. Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days.
All right.
Saturday.
We're back here at Sharp Facets Gallery, 4:40 in the afternoon. Congressman Jeff Duncan with us this afternoon. You know, you just were awarded the a recipient of the 2012 FreedomWorks Freedom Fighter Award. What did you do to earn that?
I voted for the taxpayer. You know, I voted to make sure the government didn't spend more money than it takes in and more money than it can afford and, you know, end the bailouts, the borrowing, and the takeovers, the, you know, all the bad things that are going on. So fighting for your freedom, the liberties we enjoy, getting back to constitutional government and everything that I've talked about for many, many months on this show and around the district and campaigned on. So, yeah, just go up there and vote your values. And really, that award ought to go to everybody in the 3rd District.
Absolutely. Now, also, I did want to bring this up because your picture was on the 2012 kickoff for the football for the Index Journal here, Jeff. I mean, here you go. There's Jeff Duncan right next to it. We'll have pictures of this with the YouTube video. All right, Jeff. You know, Jeff, you know, I can't believe they talked you into doing that.
Oh, Lord, only for you, man.
Oh, you did it for all of Greenwood there. Hey, yeah. It was pretty cool, pretty cool.
Well, yeah, no, this is at Regal Stadium. I was a Ware Scholes Hornet my senior year, and a good receiver, hold some school records over there, and caught a lot of footballs. And I was honored to be featured. I didn't know when I took those pictures I'd be on the front page. I just wanted to be part of Pigskins and Politics. And you know, Floyd Nicholson's down a three-point stance as a lineman. And, you know, I thought the guy was very creative with his photography. So.
Yeah, there is Floyd right there.
Yeah.
Yep,
and,
there he is right,
you know,
there.
It was good. You know, it was a good article, and I love football. I love Friday nights in South Carolina and, you know, chilling there this time of year and the lights and a little moisture on the grass and those guys getting after it. And, you know, I miss my playing days, but I enjoy going and watching the games. And I enjoy college football as well. So, you know, that was a Pigskin kickoff, and I appreciate the opportunity to be featured. It's not a great picture of me. I look mean and stern, but anyway.
Have you ever worn that outfit up there in Congress?
I keep that expression a lot up there, you know. Yeah, we were mentioning earlier a book that Robert Draper wrote called Do Not Ask What Good We Do, and on the back of it is a picture of the president's Jobs speech to Congress back in September last year. And during that speech, a buddy of mine was sitting behind me, Jeff Landry, and he wrote out a sign that says drilling equals jobs. The president was talking about jobs, and he was up there at the podium, and Jeff rolled out that sign. And, well, I heard all these cameras go off. But the picture that made the New York Times is we're sitting there, you know, we've got a stern expression because the president was just, he was laying out some things that were unrealistic. He was making some false assertions, and we disagreed with him. So.
And jobs and drilling, that's an excellent question.
Drilling equals jobs. North Dakota, and they're going gangbusters up there, 3% unemployment rate or less. Some would argue a negative unemployment rate. They've got jobs they don't have people to fill. You know, you get off a plane in North Dakota, they give you a job whether you need one or not. They need people to work up there. It's an energy-driven economy. Think about South Carolina. If we allow drilling off our coast and not just the guys that are working out there on their rigs, but it's a trickle-down economy. When you think about the people who are pipe welding and pipe fitters and people that service vehicles, you know, your mechanics, your body, you know, these trucks, they have wrecks, they hit pipes, they do other things. They, you know, the churches that receive tithes, the restaurants that receive the meals and the tips, it's a huge economy and an energy-driven economy. I think of North Dakota as the microcosm of what our country could be if we would just pursue American energy independence.
Absolutely. You know, take the Keystone Pipeline, just all the tires that would be going from South Carolina, those huge, big tires.
Well, Joe Wilson loves to pull that picture out, doesn't he?
Yeah,
but Michelin makes those huge tires that go on the big earth movers, and it's a trickle-down economy when we go after energy independence, and not counting the construction jobs, building the pipeline, the refinery jobs, refining that oil. It's a boom for the economy.
President Obama said that he would take it under advisement now, hasn't he changed his opinion just a little bit on what he might do for this?
He will say anything to get reelected. He will say, let me repeat that, he will say anything to get reelected. Oh, I'll take Keystone Pipeline under advisement. No, what he ought to say is, we're going to authorize Keystone Pipeline tomorrow. We're going to bring that Canadian oil down here. We're going to put Americans to work. We're going to meet our energy needs in this country. If we can't have American energy independence, we'll have North American energy independence. We'll trade with a friendly country to our north in Canada. They like us. We like them. We don't have to worry about oil coming through the Strait of Hormuz and Iran controlling a very narrow passageway. They don't like us very much, it seems. And so I'll take Canada over Iran any day of the week. And so I go back to the thing. You know, the definition of insanity is electing Barack Obama for four more years and expecting different results.
Yeah. That's any insanity, right?
It's any insanity, but
doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result.
In election politics and all, the definition of insanity in 2012 is reelecting Barack Hussein Obama to four more years and expecting different results out of his administration. It's not going to happen. We're going to see more of the same. You're going to see more of your liberties eroded. You're going to see gasoline continue to increase, gasoline prices at the pump. So that's less money in your pocket that you can spend other ways, sharp facets or advertising on the radio.
Can't do any less with sharp facts. I'm telling you, we're at the bottom here.
You're going to see unemployment continue at 80% or more. You're going to see more and more regulations added to the Federal Registry.
Is he doing so well in the polls?
Yeah, I don't necessarily believe the polls. I believe in the silent majority. I believe Americans that get up and go to work every day, and they work hard, they pay taxes, they support their families, and they don't answer polls, but they go and they go and vote. Sometimes they vote Democrat, sometimes they vote Republican, but they vote for the best interest in America. And I believe they've looked at the last 4 years. They realize that Barack Obama hadn't turned this thing around. Unemployment's still high. They're paying more for gasoline. They're facing higher taxes, all these negative things, and they will go and vote for a new day in America, and that is a new vision with Mitt Romney and Ryan, their presidency and vice presidency, and they'll give them a chance. And I believe in that silent majority, and I believe the polls are going to be proved wrong, and the media is going to sit there, not your media, but the mainstream media will sit there with their mouth agape wondering what happened. How do they miss it that bad? It's because they want to miss it that bad. They're skewing these numbers. If you look at, I think Dick Morris did a great job explaining polling, how if they did a sample, and they got the results, and they said, well, we had too many women here, so we're going to cull down the women to make it more uniform. Or we had too many kids that were 18 to 25. We're going to cull some of them out. And it gets their desired result by creating a sample that to meets their needs. So I don't trust polling,
not polling.
At the national level.
Well, now let's talk about a couple other things here, though. You know, you had your first bill passed. Had to do with South America and making sure that our interests down there, our embassies and whatnot, are taken care of and protected. And yet, you passed this here. It hasn't passed this Senate. Is that correct?
That's correct. It was up for unanimous consent in the Senate, and one senator objected, so it wasn't unanimous. We're working with that senator to try to reach a compromise on making some language changes. And their holdup was they want some of this report to be classified. The language in the bill is how every other report like this, and the national strategy that we come up with, is the same as how they're done. So part of it is classified, part of it is open. It's the same language. I don't understand his objection. So we're working with his office to try to meet that. Hopefully it'll be back up in a lame duck if we go back and have a unanimous consent over there and get it passed. And it's the right thing for America.
But let me just ask you something. You know, I think that's great. Congratulations on passing your first bill here. But then we go to Libya, Egypt. We had plenty of notification for what I'm seeing in the reports and everything out there. And yet we let our ambassador sit there with no real protection. And now they're taking it back. I mean, what would be the difference in this versus what they have in Egypt and Libya?
Well, you know, how to compare apples and apples there, I don't know. What this does is it says, look, there's a lot of people within the intelligence community and within Congress and all across America that understand that we see an increase of Iranian presence in the Western Hemisphere. They've opened six embassies in Latin America or South America in the last 5 years. Areas where they've never had any cultural, social, or economic ties before. Many people raise their eyebrows at that. I traveled down to Ciudad del Este in Paraguay, and it's a huge tri-border region where Paraguay and Brazil and Argentina all come together. It's an area controlled by Hezbollah. All the business and industry, mainly retail, right there in Ciudad del Este, City of the East, all the money goes to Hezbollah. all the money funds terrorist operations around the globe through that area. So what happens, Brazilians come over and they buy these goods, and they're usually Chinese knockoff goods, and they buy them. That money's skimmed. A percentage of it goes to Hezbollah. A percentage stays there with the owner of the retail shop. The rent is skimmed for Hezbollah. That funds terrorist organizations. We just found out that there was a Hezbollah training camp. What kind of training? I don't know. In Nicaragua. That was just revealed recently, within the last couple of weeks. 2 weeks ago, they arrested three Hezbollah operatives in Mexico. We saw last year Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is an Iranian proxy, by the way, a terrorist organization on the terrorist list. Hezbollah operative, basically a Quds force, Iranian Revolutionary Guard, Special Forces person, was arrested in Mexico. He had made contact with who he believed to be a Mexican drug cartel person, happened to be a DEA agent undercover, a U.S. Undercover agent, and he wanted the drug cartel to help him get across the United States border, come into this country so he could go to Washington, D.C., and assassinate the ambassador from Saudi Arabia to the United States in D.C., or his backup plan was to bomb the Israeli embassy. So the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's special forces are here. And we just had yesterday in Arizona, in an area where I was just recently, a Border Patrol agent was killed while he was on horseback. They haven't caught the guys yet, whether they were drug smugglers or whether they were Hezbollah terrorist operatives smuggling into this country. I don't know, because as of today, they haven't caught that person yet. And so, you know, I'm trying to raise awareness with my bill about the real threat here at home. You know, we can talk about the Iranian threat of nuclear Iran. We can talk about Libya and the Muslim Brotherhood and all these other bad things that are going on around the world. Our failure to support Israel to the level that we've supported them in the past, the failure of our president to meet with the Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel recently when Netanyahu was in the United States. They were in the same city, and he wouldn't take the time to sit down and talk to the guy.
He had to go to the view.
I know.
Right.
That was more important with Babwa. But anyway.
Well, he was eye candy.
That's what they said. I mean,
he said he was the eye candy. That's what President Obama said.
I want him to be the president of the United States and act presidential and support our allies instead of being eye candy on The View. You know, we're not talking about, you know, fun and games here. We're talking about an existential threat to the state of Israel, a longstanding ally of the United States, and he will fail to take time out of his busy eye candy schedule to provide the leadership of this country and meet with one of our allies at a very, very important time, probably a global threat that we've never seen, at least in my lifetime. You know, that's the situation that we're in. So in my mind, Ann, I think, why in the world would anybody in this country reelect this guy who has failed us on so many fronts, from foreign policy to domestic policy, energy policy to tax policy, unemployment? I mean, come on. And so I don't even know what we were talking about there, how we got on that.
I was concerned about how we could not, I mean, the reports that are now coming out in Libya, that we're not taking care of our embassies over there. We don't have enough people. Something about making sure that we can't fire back under attack if we were under attack. Should we not have our own people there? And is it not a responsibility of the countries where we have an embassy for them to protect us?
Absolutely. That is the agreement worldwide, that the host country would protect the embassies of other countries, whether it's U.S. or another country. And so Libya had the responsibility. They, as it's reported today, they had raised awareness that there wasn't enough security there. They had some issues with the U.K. company that was providing security for them as a contract, and it was basically ignored by the United States State Department.
Does that come back to Hillary Clinton?
Absolutely. The buck stops there. It ought to go back all the way to the president's desk. I mean, he's responsible for the State Department. He appoints their Secretary of State. She's responsible for everybody and everything that goes on under. And so, absolutely, the buck stops there. When are we going to see somebody from this administration take responsibility for something? You know, they didn't take responsibility for the moratorium. We had to issue a congressional subpoena. They haven't taken responsibility for Brian Terry's death down at Fast and Furious. They haven't taken responsibility for what happened in Libya. We continue to see foul policies. Maybe the president would spend some time going to his national security daily briefing instead of just trying to read it on his iPad. Maybe if he'd go and sit down with the people that are in the know and have the intelligence to ask follow-up questions and extrapolate.
Look at them eye to eye.
And look at them eye to eye, get emphasis, and extrapolate certain pieces of information that might be important versus trying to read something in a one dimension on his iPad. I think that's important. You know, you and I have had a conversation here. You've asked me questions to, you know, to get a further understanding of what I've just talked about.
Sure.
Isn't that important in a national security realm that the president asks the people that are smarter than him, that have more information than him? Well, exactly what do you mean when you say there's problems with the Libyan contractors that are providing security in Benghazi? What do you mean by that? Well, shouldn't we renegotiate that contract or maybe find other security? Can we get Hillary Clinton on the phone and maybe address this issue? Those are the kind of questions you ask if you have a conversation. If you read a story on your iPad or a daily briefing on your iPad, you say, well, I'll follow up on that later and not get to it. I'm sorry. It's wrong for him not to take the responsibility to sit in front of somebody and have a daily security briefing. You know, my personal liberties, my property, my family, the country I love, the men and women that are serving our country overseas, the men and women that are serving our country in uniform, are all in jeopardy if he makes a wrong decision.
Look at what we've had in Afghanistan. I mean, some of the interior coming into the areas and killing some of our people.
Well, it gets back to rules of engagement. You know, it's war. You want to be feel good about it. You know, you've got a guy sitting on a hillside that has a cell phone or radio to his ear, and he's calling in mortar strikes on our personnel, but because he doesn't have a gun, they can't engage him. And so he continues to call in mortar strikes that kill American personnel. The rules of engagement won't allow them to go after that guy or shoot him. You know, I'm sorry. It's war. And we've got to have the resolve and the dedication to win the thing and do it right with the right rules of engagement. Same in Libya, same in Egypt with our Marines and other people that are protecting us. They've got to have real bullets in the gun. They've had guns that fire. And the border, you know, we talked about the CBP and our border earlier. I went down there and I saw the paintball guns.
Paintball guns.
Paintball guns. They're glorified paintball guns that they use to shoot at the illegals that are coming across.
Just mark them?
They mark them with a certain kind of paint. They also make a sound that, generally the illegals that are coming just for work and other things, they're not, even the smugglers, the guys that, you know, they're just doing this for a job, bringing the drugs in. Usually they stop, usually.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the guys on horseback that were killed yesterday? What kind of weapon did they have? Did they have actual sidearms or long guns, rifles, AR-15s, M4s? Or were they shooting paintball guns at these folks? That's what I want to know. Those are some questions I have, and these are real facts. I shot one. I'm not telling you something that I'm making up. They have two different kinds, and one shoots a pepper-type ball. It's a little harder. It stings a little more, but it releases pepper spray, so it kind of disorients you there a little bit. And the other one's a glorified paintball gun. That's what our CBP officers are using, non-lethal weapons.
To cover our borders.
To cover our borders in certain areas.
Unbelievable.
Now, there are some that carry weapons and the right kind of firearms, and they're doing a tremendous job given the rules of engagement that they've had and given the policies that they have to operate under. But I say we've got to change those policies. We've got to secure our border, and we've got to take this mission very, very seriously. I don't want to see another CBP agent to fall to smugglers like this one did.
Absolutely. We have been here with Congressman Jeff Duncan. He is running for re-election. You are listening to WCRS right here in Greenwood. Would you like to make a closing comment on why you should be going back to Congress?
Well, I just simply point to my record and what I've done over the last 2 years, and I've done exactly what the voters sent me to Washington to do. I am running for re-election. I hope I'll have your support and your vote on November the 6th. I hope you'll vote for Mitt Romney at the top. I'll be the second one on the ballot, Jeff Duncan. I hope you'll vote for me, and then come on down the line and look at all the candidates and vote for the ones that best represent your values and your beliefs and you, that you believe will represent you best in whatever capacity it is. We've got a lot of petition candidates out there this year, and so I think it's important that folks look at all the candidates and vote for them individually. But I'd love to have your vote, and I'll continue to support the things that we believe in here in South Carolina and try to represent you to the best of my ability. And at the end of the day, I'm just Jeff. I'm here for you. I'm accessible. Join me, sign up on Facebook, follow me there, follow me on Twitter. We're very transparent and open, and if you have a question, we've got offices all over the 3rd District. We're very accessible, and that's how we want to be. We want to serve the district. I think we've done it very well doing that. I think I've got a great staff to meet your needs, whether it's here in Greenwood with Janice McCord and Jan Harmon, or whether it's over in Lawrence with Robin and Lance, or whether it's up in Anderson with Rick and Tasha and Walker and Jordan Scherer and all the ones that we've got on staff here or in D.C. I've got a great staff up there. If you got a concern, let me know about it, and I'll deal with it. So.
Absolutely. Well, Congressman Jeff Duncan, it's been a pleasure to have you here. I certainly hope we'll get you back on the air before very long, and I hope to be in Washington first of the year.
Well, I look forward to being there as we're sworn in for the 113th Congress, and I'm just humbled by the opportunity to serve, and as I always say, and I love you. I think you do a great job, and I appreciate what you do for our nation and for our state, for me personally, and may God continue to bless you, and always God bless America. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. God bless you, Jeff Duncan. That's going to wrap it up for us. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Bye-bye, everybody.